The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. The Grammy-winning King Singers are an a cappella vocal ensemble founded in 1968 when they were formed by six choral scholars at King's College in Cambridge, England. And their repertory is broad and varied, from medieval sacred music to contemporary commissions and everything in between. Their 2020 recording, Finding Harmony, exemplifies their commitment to that variety, with selections from 12th century Georgian polyphony to Ariana Grande, and music from Mexico, South Africa, Scotland. The title Finding Harmony has a double meaning, because the King Singers say they intend for it to harness the positive power of music to bring people together and effect social change. Two members of the King Singers join me to talk about Finding Harmony, baritone Chris Brewerton and baritone Nick Ashby. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And before we get into your recording, though, I'd like each of you to give a thumbnail of your own personal path in music leading to the King Singers. So, you know, when did you start singing? Where'd you train? How long have you been with the group? That sort of thing. Why don't you begin?
Mine was quite a traditional route in terms of the English choral tradition, which is a rich heritage in the UK. We're really lucky to have a load of cathedrals, which have kids who sing in the front rows of the choirs, boys and girls. And I grew up singing through that tradition as a young chorister, knee high to a grasshopper, you know, still in short shorts, singing at kind of age six. I think I joined a cathedral choir, and I started singing all the way through my childhood in all different choirs. And then, after graduating from university in York, up in the north of England, I moved to London and started singing with the likes of the Talis Scholars and these other early music ensembles there's so many of them in the UK, and we're lucky to have a rich choral tradition, and started touring the world with them. And then just a couple of years ago, I ended up luckily getting the call to audition for the King Singers, and the rest is history for me.
Wow.
But Chris over here has got a slightly more interesting route.
Oh, okay.
Well, I had a similar route, but just in a place far, far away in Lord of the Rings territory. I grew up in New Zealand, and but I sang in a cathedral choir, which was one of the only cathedral choirs outside of England to be based on that English model. So I went to a choir school, and we would rehearse before school every morning and sing the daily even songs after school. And then I continued through into my university studies and studied performance voice with a minor, as they say over here, in French. And then I just was a teacher for a few years, and then I thought, if I don't give it a go now, I'll always wonder what if. So I bought a one-way ticket to England to try and become a professional singer full-time, and I joined Christchurch Cathedral Choir, Oxford, our namesake, and then I got a call about a year after moving to the country, would I like to audition for the King Singers. And so here we are 8 years later, having spent a fair few parts of my life in aeroplanes and whatnot, but having a great time and enjoying all the local delights of all the best places to eat and the best places to drink coffee and all those sorts of things around the world. So it's been a wild ride from, you know, my humble beginnings in New Zealand.
Wow, yeah. What great, both of you have great stories. That's exciting. So speaking of wide travels, the music on Finding Harmony, it covers 11 significant and iconic episodes of history, and it's pretty heavy stuff, from the Protestant Reformation in Europe to the 2017 Manchester bombings. That's a pretty tall order. So I thought we could maybe break it down into smaller bits and kind of go through how you chose the overall arc of the repertory on it, and either one of you can start.
I think it was such an interesting subject. As soon as we came up with the idea of Finding Harmony for our next project and our next album and our next sort of social mission, we realized, as we were scratching away at this idea, that this idea of music that has brought people together and communities together in hard times is appears throughout history, and you see it in all different countries and all different cultures, and it's one of the key USPs, shall we say, of the King Singers is that we've always, as you mentioned earlier, sung a broad variety of music and genres as far-fetched as medieval plain chant right through to John Legend, and so actually it felt very relevant and appropriate for us to try and look at as many of these different periods as possible, and it's still linked through our own filter of our six voices and our a cappella style. But what's fascinating on the album is having something like Kesha's Praying right next to Bird's Ne Yoruscaris, and the two complement each other in an odd way. You realise this linking theme of music that has empowered maybe marginalised communities. They both have something that one can offer the other, and it's a fascinating mix.
Mm. Yeah, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think when we were looking at putting this together, we kind of divided and conquered, if you like. So I was tasked with finding out about music from Australasia, from Australia and New Zealand, that perhaps had a significance in terms of the local communities being oppressed and how music helped them through those times. That was a really interesting journey, going back and speaking to experts back home and finding new contacts in Australia with the Aboriginal people and also the Torres Strait Islanders, the two Indigenous communities in Australia that for a long time have struggled for significance in that country. I mean, the Aboriginals came and settled in Australia 47,000 years ago, and yet they're still, to this day, suffering from the sort of problems with society and the endemic, I'd say, racism and marginalisation of those different communities, and so it's really hard even to this day. They're still fighting for significance, and they've been there 47,000 years. I mean, that blows my mind. So that was really interesting for me to go back home. Jules was tasked with Georgia, and looking through
in Eastern Europe rather than the South of America.
Yes,
south of the US.
Johnny was tasked with apartheid South Africa and civil rights America. Pat volunteered for the early music because that was his specialty at university. And then we just kind of found out the other ones, as we had a bit more time on our hands. But it was really interesting being a researcher for a change. It's often something that other people have done, and we, can spend time looking through other people's works and go, oh, that's a great thing. But when you are the person going and finding things and spending hours listening to clips and making contact with experts and waiting for responses and then seeing where that conversation takes you, it's a really interesting process. And I think we're a lot more engaged in this project because of that, because from the very beginning we were all, it rested entirely on us as to how much we wanted to put into it.
Yeah.
So even now we're still thinking, what about Finding Harmony 2? What next? And are there more stories to tell as we travel the world?
I suspect there will be. So that's really interesting. I guess I've always imagined that you are, or at least you consider yourself, sort of co-artistic directors, if you will, because, you are all guiding what you're going to do, what you're going to tackle. But as you say, this is probably the most hands-on. So who would normally have been doing that?
Well, I think when we come up with a program, those of us who are tasked with coming up with a few ideas to present to the group, we'll be thinking of general themes that have come and gone. One classic King Singers program is sort of an evening with the King Singers, and we explore about five or so different periods of history, and we do groups, and that's been a pretty common theme throughout all our programming for the past 50 years. But then there are, specific things that we want to look into, and whether that's a particular sort of contemporary program or a love songs theme or something like that. And I guess so much of the music that is in our library has been gathered by different group members in the past, and so we have 3,000 songs to choose from. So in a way, we don't need to look outside that for inspiration if we don't want to, and we've still got more than enough to come up with, you know, interesting programs. But mm-hmm. what's interesting is to go, well, despite what we have, what else is there? And is it interesting to sort of see, is there anything in our library already that you know, comes under this umbrella of Whānau Harmony? And if not, we're going to have to get some new arrangements done. And so that was interesting to kind of talk to experts to get a legit voice for this, because we're not tone deaf. We are totally appreciative of the fact that six white guys singing about civil rights America, you know, it has to be done with sensitivity and authenticity, so that right. it doesn't come across as cultural appropriation or any of those right. sorts of things. So we went to experts and we got their blessing, and we are merely a voice for their artistic, you know, ideas.
Like a conduit, you know.
Right.
We are a fantastic arranger from Tennessee, a guy called Stacey V. Gibbs. He's a phenomenal guy, and we've met him a few times now, and he seems to beam with joy when he sees us singing his stuff, and yeah,
he's cool. He grew up with countless sisters singing all these sorts of songs, you know, in the Southern Baptist Church sort of tradition, and so for him to arrange some of these songs for us was just a trip down memory lane for him, and it meant a lot to him.
Wow.
And so we have a real, you know, authentic arrangement of some of his, you know, of his works, and they're just fantastic.
Wow. So who, that was actually my next question, is who did the arranging? Because obviously you have such a mixed bag of stuff, so we know what some of those were covered by Stacey, but who else?
Well, as Chris mentioned, in every episode we try to, well, we always got someone who is linked to the message of the episode. For example, our Scottish section was arranged by Sir James McMillan, who, as you know, one of the most phenomenal UK composers live today, and we're so lucky to have him arrange some stuff for us. And then the beautiful Mexican song Cielito Lindo we got arranged by Jorge Cotzatl, who's a great friend of the group from many years gone by. Kesha's Praying, used by the hashtag MeToo movement a few years ago, was arranged by a phenomenal composer called Rebecca Dale. And we always sort of made sure that there's an appropriate voice being being heard, and that we could amplify.
Yeah, and for the apartheid section, we got a guy called Neil Moyanga, who is a South African composer and an amazing person in that line of work, and is doing some great stuff around the world, bringing South African stories to the world. He's based in Brazil, and works with an amazing dance troupe as well, and they do these incredible productions where they discuss sort of social issues of the day, you know, particularly in South Africa. And he gives such an authentic voice to that section of this program, which is just so cool. So you know, these freedom songs that were sung with, you know, Nelson Mandela and you know, and whatnot, you know, to have someone like him who can give an authentic voice is so important. And
it's going to be much better than anything that we try to produce ourselves.
It just can't have some sort of diluted
westernized
you have to go to the source, you know what I mean? Yeah. So that's been fascinating, having those conversations and trying to marry the two worlds together, because some of these guys hadn't written for six-part male a cappella before, so that had to be a conversation as well about how it suits us and how we can give the best performance. So it took about a year to 18 months from start to finish before we started putting these things down in the recording studio. And so we felt that we couldn't rush the process. If it was going to be right, it had to be done right. And if that meant we had to take time for these things to sort of formulate and whatnot, then that was the right decision. And it's meant that our relationships with these key experts are even greater, even more in depth, and they're friends for life now, which is great. And so we've got some people to go to back to if we ever want to explore some of these episodes a little bit more.
So I'm wondering, you know, both artistically and even from a technique standpoint, what is it like to sing these different genres? I mean, you have to, I would think, approach it very differently. Even you know, opera singers versus early music singers have different considerations. So what kinds of different considerations did you have to make when you were singing the different parts of this recording?
You're absolutely right. Yeah, you have to approach just like you would approach any piece with a different sort of emotional message behind it. You need to approach every different genre with its with an appropriate style. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a big favoring of singing early music with quite a straight tone nowadays. But the a rich, straight, warm tone with lots of harmonics might not be appropriate for Ariana Grande or Kesha, or so that might need a softer, more poppy color. And that's something that us as a six and our previous members of the group over the years have always worked hard on is what's the appropriate sound to make for each different genre, and how do we best get that? Sometimes it's, you know, making silly trombone noises, or, you know, replicating the sound of a mariachi band, or it might be how best can we get the beauty out of this music. The polyphony, for example, you know, requires a great dexterity of balancing the interweaving lines so beautifully to make sure that when you're important you're sticking out, but no one part is not tune and accompaniment, and so you know mm-hmm. it's those sorts of sensitivities that it's really fun for us to work on and mm-hmm. and develop that's I think what makes it so exciting listening to this album and putting this album together as well. You know, we're recording two songs which are 300-500 years apart, possibly more, and then Chris over here gets to do some gorgeous solos from this Eastern European Georgian music, mm-hmm. Which have their own idiosyncrasies and twiddles and turns and ornaments, and it's just gorgeous to listen to him doing that on the Tinskara.
I think further to what Nick's saying, I think part of it is the language itself, because when you listen to a South African person speaking in Xhosa and all those like tongue clicks and things, mm-hmm. you know, it's such a different way of producing sound to the way the Georgians will say "kva" and all sorts of these sorts of guttural sounds as well. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the Mexican, which is really bright and ay 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 ay, canta no llores porque, you know, it's a really, and that's completely different to the German stuff that we're singing from the sort of the Reformation times, you know, with pretty standard Bach kind of, you know, sounds, you know, with what I think just like a normal German would sound today. But that in itself is completely different, again, to how it's appropriate to sing an American spiritual with a slight English sort of twist, because we didn't feel like we should go full American. We thought that wouldn't be authentic for us. Mm-hmm. But again, those are the sorts of considerations that one has to think about.
We spent hours agonizing over all this stuff.
I bet.
And we had language coaches, and uh-huh. and they worked with us, so we know that what we've put down is hopefully as close to a local person as we could muster. Mm-hmm. And we spend a lot of time, and we pride ourselves on putting in a pretty good attempt at these things, because it's important. It can't sound like, oh, that sounds like a British person on holiday trying to read a sign in Georgian. You know, it has to be, you know, a really good version. So
sure.
it took us a long time.
Sure. Well, it conveys respect, and it also conveys an understanding, as you say, that, you know, you're not going to culturally appropriate, but also that you want to be. You want
sensitive.
To be authentic to yourselves and sensitive. Exactly. Yeah. Mm. Exactly. That's great. So what kind of outreach or other activities are you engaged in, if at all, to go with this? Because there really is such a strong component of activism and awareness and connection to some of these very important issues and milestones in history. Are you doing anything outside of the concert hall to kind of support the performances?
We are. A big part of what we do is education. Mm-hmm. It's been a growing part of the business over, you know, certainly over my time. Mm-hmm. I've seen a big change, and there's been a real increase in educational outreach, mm-hmm. And community engagement, and that's great for me, because as a former teacher, I feel like I'm still keeping my foot in the door, mm-hmm. and it's great, as membership has changed, actually, the way things are now, you've got six teachers, which hasn't always been the case. It's not that you haven't had people engaged in teaching, but there's a more natural fit now than I think certainly I've noticed, which is great, you know, to have five fellow teachers to sort of do the work around all the places that we go, and so we love doing as many you know teaching opportunities as possible, and whether that's a week long residential summer school in Cambridge last year or Princeton this year, or whether it's a drop in masterclass, or you know it's hugely important to complement the work that we do on stage, to grow audiences and to encourage the next generation of singers to want to go out and do it themselves.
Right. In terms of the like Finding Harmony outreach stuff, when earlier, that was last year, wasn't it? We were down in Louisiana, and a charity that we've set up in the US called the King Singers Global Foundation raised funds for a coachload of school students from a high school in
Kilgore,
Texas, to drive over the border. And come and have a masterclass with us for free in the afternoon, and then come and watch our concert in the evening. The whole choir had never left their state before, and half of them had never even left Kilgore before. So,
wow.
So this was turned out to be a huge trip for them, and we weren't really aware of this at the time. And these kids sort of like rocked up and were like, all right, who are these six guys? And by the end of the concert, they were wow. Hopefully really inspired, seemingly anyway. And the choir went on to win some fantastic competition a couple of weeks later, and it was such a joy to work with them. We've got a few instances like this throughout the year, and the next year coming up where we'll be doing these sorts of right time, right place sort of outreach work for free through this charity. And also we've just announced our ambassadors, Finding Harmony ambassadors, a few choirs in the UK who we feel are resonating the same ethos as this Finding Harmony mission that we're doing. So mm-hmm. one is a choir for heavily disabled people. Another one is a choir for prisoners. So a prison in south of England. Some friends of ours go in and teach these prisoners how to sing opera, and they perform operas together at the after a term or so of sessions. And the third choir
is from London, and it's called Together Productions, and they have a choir made up of refugees from overseas who have been tortured and in their different communities in their sort of war torn countries, and they live in London now. They've been relocated, and this is a great opportunity for them to come together and to sing and use music as a healing tool, and so they do amazing stuff. So we've got this first one that Nick mentioned is called Soundabout Choir, and based out of Oxford, so that's a nice local one to me. and then the second one is the Prison Choir Project in Dartmoor Prison, and then this one in London, which is so cool.
It'll be really interesting developing a relationship with them and seeing again more how the power of music can bond and heal, and
because these guys are already doing this, so we wanted to give them a grant to support what they were doing, and then to do some workshops with them, and then at the end of May we've got it's called Finding Harmony Live, and it's an event in London where these three groups will come together and we'll do lots of singing together, and there'll be some talking, and it's going to be a really great event. All the details to be sort of finalised, but it's great to know that we can support the work that they're doing and hopefully garner a relationship for the future as well.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, so it's very exciting.
Well, all of these things too are great examples of the importance of people and relationships, and whether it's outreach with kids or whether it's outreach to prisons or refugees. But there's also the personal relationship between the six of you, and you even alluded to that before about having teachers, you know, that you are all, you're sharing the responsibility, but you also are committed to the teaching and have that sort of in your DNA as well. I'm also curious to know about just what's that relationship like when you play chamber music, or when you sing together, when you make music with other people. It can be technically very proficient and excellent, But when you have that personal relationship that overlays it, it really kind of takes it to the next level. So I wonder what that's like between the six of you. Do you feel, I mean, it's almost like a family. You travel, you eat together, you do fun things together. You have to get along well.
We see each other more than we see our family.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, by many months, I would say.
Right.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think if we didn't get on well, then it would be really obvious on the stage for the audience in the music, mm-hmm. in the music making. There's something lovely. I mean, it's one of the joys of chamber music making. It's what I love the most about it is that subconscious connection where mm-hmm. you kind of, you know that maybe someone's not feeling a little as, you know, vocally on form like they might do or whatever. And so you're kind of there to support them or whatever. And there's, do you know what I mean? There's like subconscious connection throughout the group.
I think singing on stage with mates is the best way to make music. Yeah. You know, whether it's paid or unpaid, just get a bunch of people together that you enjoy spending time with and make music. You know, I think that's what it's about. Mm-hmm. The joy for us is that, yes, it is our full-time job, and we get to hang out with five mates and tour the world and have fun times. And it genuinely is a dream job. You know,
yeah.
and you can't always say that. You know, and so it's pretty thrilling. But it also means that because you're that close, you have to find time as well to have time to yourself and mm-hmm. to connect with home and mm-hmm. and we each have different home lives mm-hmm. and a couple of us are married, Jules is engaged and mm-hmm. and Nick and Eddie are in long-term relationships and mm-hmm. and I think Johnny's on the market, so if you know any people in
okay.
Cincinnati, then
okay.
you know, he's there for one more night.
Exactly.
But you know, it's really important to be able to communicate well,
mm-hmm.
and we work hard at that, mm-hmm. and we work hard at being honest and respectful, mm-hmm. and it's okay to disagree as long as you can agree to disagree, mm-hmm. you know, because then at least you've still agreed, you know what I mean?
Right.
So
right.
we have aligned musical thoughts, but at times they do differ, and I think the great thing about this group is that we can try different things. Mm-hmm. And it's usually pretty obvious after trying one, two, maybe three different ways of doing a phrase or something, mm-hmm. What's right for the group that in that moment. And it might be that in different acoustics the very next night, someone else's suggestion might be more appropriate. And so, you know, it swings and roundabouts. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
But ultimately, I think a group of, you know, around six or eight people or 10 people or whatever, music makers, I think it's always the overall product is always going to be better than the sum of its parts if it's a democratic process like we have. Like the six of us are all equal levels, equal partners in the group, and we all have equal say on mm-hmm. You know, and on musical ideas or whatever it is. So we all have a voice to be heard, and we're not being led by one person, and I think that makes us all feel really heavily invested in what we're doing, mm-hmm. rather than just an instrument in part of group or whatever.
And I think I agree. And I think the other thing to think about is it's not about being right or wrong. It's just about being together. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the essence of chamber music or small ensemble music or well, mm-hmm. perhaps any music? You know.
Yeah.
And right. So you can have as many conversations as you like, but once the red light goes on or once the curtain's open, you have to be of one mind.
Right.
So you have to be able to put things to one side and go, this is what the group has decided is the best thing to try tonight, and let's review it afterwards.
Right.
Let's be open and humble and realize that maybe it might not work.
Right.
But let's do it together, uniformly, and then let's go back to the drawing board if we need to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a professional approach.
Sure.
You know.
And I think, like anything, music evolves over time and interpretation evolves over time. Your ensemble has evolved over time. You guys were not alive when the King Singers were formed,
yeah.
right? So,
sure.
You know, so the ensemble itself has evolved. So, of course, it's going to evolve in how you present the music. So
exactly.
It's got to be true to the people who are on the stage as well.
Right,
so,
right.
So if you've inherited some traditions of performing from a previous lineup that don't sit right with you, who you are as a performer and
right.
as just a person,
right.
then you've got to feel like you're going to be able to speak up about that and say, actually, I'm not so comfortable with this. You know?
Yeah.
It's cool.
So other than finding harmony too, what's next for the King Singers? What kinds of wish list projects do you have?
Wow, that's a good question.
That's a big question. That's a question we're asking ourselves as well at the moment.
I'd say a wish list project would include locations as well. I'm always going to be in favour of a tour back home to New Zealand and Australia because it's the great parts of the world. And touring life down there is a lot of fun, but it's a long way to go. Mm-hmm. I'd love to go back to the Philippines because they make you feel like a rock star. And in the choral music world, that's not a term that's often bandied about. So but in terms of music, oh man, that is a great question. I love the jazz idiom. I loved doing the Great American Songbook album, and that was the first time I felt like an even member of the group, if you know what I mean, because up until that point, I'd been treading water in the sense that I was catching up to everyone else. They knew all the repertoire, and then that was the first project that we did all together that was brand new, and I thought, oh, actually, I can do this, you know, and I'm on an even keel, and and I just loved it, and I felt so free to do all the jazz stuff because it's so unchoral, if you know what I mean. You know,
right.
When you grow up in the cathedral choir, standing behind stalls and singing a Magnificat and Nunc Dimittis and whatnot, and psalms and hymns and anthems, jazz could not be further away. And so, I really sort of came to my own for that, and I love that. And so, more of that would always get my vote. What about you?
I just think some sort of interesting collaboration. I mean, we've been lucky to work with some amazing musicians over the years. You know, Evelyn Glennie with that whole album of percussion street songs and all sorts of cool things. And I just wonder who's out there now that we would resonate really well with, not necessarily just other singers, but or even necessarily other musicians, maybe artists of some sort of interesting, like, animation or like some sort of installation, art something. I don't know. Ooh. I was walking around the Met Gallery in New York a couple of days ago, and I was thinking, I wonder what we could do.
I've always thought the sort of intersection between music and other sort of mediums is really interesting. So how do people respond to an artwork if there's music going on in the background that might be of that style or
your Monet and your Debussy and
or something, are we influenced by music when we eat food or drink wine, you know, and how do you play around with people's senses and at the same time, you know, and so I've always wanted to do a project in an art gallery that was sort of about a specific genre of art that had sort of music in tow, and I don't know.
One in a restaurant would be cool, but the problem is I just get food envy the entire time. I don't think I'd be able to sing at all.
Well, I have been speaking with Chris Brewerton and Nick Ashby, two baritones who are members of the Grammy-winning British vocal ensemble, the King's Singers. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Susan.
Almost had me fooled. Told me that I was nothing without you. But after everything you've done, I can thank you for how strong I have become.